Paul suddenly raised his head and bolted off down into the valley, saying only, "Dinner!" They built their fire, gathered armloads of grass to pad their sleeping rolls, and Perry took the horses to water while Mags tried his luck fishing. Then Perry staked the horses on the top of the bluff with enough line that they could eat their fill. He checked Dallin's legs again and salved the bites, but it seemed that Slytha had remarkably clean mouths. The bites were all sealed shut, and there was no sign at all of infection. Perry lay down in the grass with the warm sun on him and let it bake his muscles. He came to the conclusion, mentally probing the mild aches, that it wasn't so much the climbing that had strained them as all the hauling up. He'd been the one bringing up all the big foundation branches that the ravens couldn't carry, and that wasn't something he did a lot of. He'd used muscles for that he just wasn't used to using.
So far, this trip hasn't really been dangerous.
He wasn't sure how to feel about that.
The Slytha weren't really going to do much besides nick us.
On the one hand, he probably should be relieved that things hadn't actually been dangerous. On the other hand, after all the build-up, he was a little disappointed that things had been so very quiet. He'd been expecting legendary monsters, and so far, all he'd gotten was a swarm of giant weasels. He must have dozed off, because he came to with a start as Laurel dropped two fat hares on his chest.
"One for your dinner, and one for your breakfast," the Kyrie said. "I'm going to sleep so I can watch in the night."
Perry cleaned both hares, skinned one and spitted it over the fire, hanging the other in the tree they were camping under. Mags trudged up the slope with their leather bucket full of water in one hand and nothing in the other. Evidently, fishing hadn't gone well.
"Thanks, Laurel," his father said, spotting the hare over the fire.
Laurel grunted, eyes closed, as Mags settled down to take over the cooking. Perry took the bucket of water from him to hang in the tree.
"Well, as you can expect, I would like to talk about the fight we just had." "I have just one question," his father said, turning the spit slowly. "Did you go running off after the calls for help, or did Laurel start and you followed?"
"He started. I followed," Perry replied honestly. "But I didn't think about it. I just ran off when he did, trusting he knew what he was doing."
"Potentially reckless. But I think you can be forgiven that much," Mags replied. "If someone's going to set a trap for humans using a mind-speaking call for help, they're not going to do it in your range. They're going to do it in mine. I figured immediately that the very worst that would happen would be that some creature trying to lure other animals in for dinner was about to have the worst day of its life when you and Laurel showed up."
Perry blinked a little, realizing that was true.
"But I didn't know that, or think about it," he admitted.
"I did. Dallin and I might not have been able to stop Laurel, but we could have stopped you easily. Fortunately, we didn't need to." Dallin concluded with Laurel that the call was genuine.
His father looked up from the hare and smiled.
"You'll remember this for the next time."
Perry nodded soberly. He realized he had been so caught up in hearing the call for help and wanting desperately to answer it, and that he had trusted Laurel's judgment so completely that he hadn't thought about those things for himself. But his father wasn't done.
"Now, as I said, it was wildly unlikely anything that could really hurt us had used the call for help only someone with animal mind speech could hear. Your gift is ridiculously rare, Perry, and normally the people who have it are also healers. Even if Dallin and I had not been there, you and Laurel could have driven the Slytha pack off. But the chance that such a call is a ruse is something you should take a moment to consider if something like this ever happens again."
Mags turned the hare, then poked at it judiciously with his knife.
"I think this is done."
Perry got a piece of wood that he'd split for the fire. His father used it as a crude platter and divided the hare between them. Then they sat on their bedrolls and enjoyed the peace and quiet until the sun set. Perry was about to wake Laurel when the Kyrie lifted his head, heaved himself to his feet, and shook himself all over.
"I shall take the night watch. I shall wake one of you if I tire," the Kyrie said,
then sat down on his haunches and stared out over the valley.
"I think that is my signal to sleep," Mag
settled himself, pulled a blanket over himself, and was asleep in moments. But Perry wasn't ready to sleep yet. There were too many questions in his mind.
"Laurel, do bond birds usually stay behind when Hawk Brothers leave?"
"Hawks, falcons, eagles, and owls? No.
The corvids sometimes, especially if the Vale has been crowded with them. A pair will stay behind or move off into unclaimed wilderness, raising enough young to form a mob, and only then go deeper into the Peligirs in search of a Vale that has no or few corvids. It is much safer for the corvids to travel as a mob. They usually bond as a mob, and a pair is usually safe enough in the old Vale to remain until they have a mob.
Well, that was a much more detailed answer than he had expected. Why don't the others do that?
Because even the ravens are the smallest of the bond birds. Hawks, falcons, eagles, and owls are big enough, and they have enough defenses, that they can confidently travel alone. They can migrate to a new Vale when their own Vale has too many of their bloodline, or just live out in the wilderness. You have not seen a bond bird. They are formidable. The smallest are quite large enough to make me think twice before attacking. The largest can easily kill a man.
Suddenly, he was overcome with the desire to see one, or more, and their hawk brothers, and a Vale. There was a note of amusement in Laurel's mind voice.
All in good time. For now, we need to pursue this mystery of missing humans wherever it takes us.
Perry nodded in the darkness. He had the sick feeling that he wasn't going to like where this took them, but he would follow the clues anyway. Laurel woke Perry sometime in the night so he could take over while Laurel had a nap. He got out of his blankets, looked up at the stars for a reference, and reckoned it was 4 to 6 candle marks till dawn. He could stay up for 2 or 3, then wake his father. Dallin dozed nearby, standing hip-shot, which was a very good sign that his legs weren't hurting him. If they had been, he would be lying down now. There was no need to get up from where he sat, and a very good reason not to. The less he moved, the less likely it was that anything out there would spot him. He collected the remains of the hare, all bones, they'd sucked every bit of meat from the carcass, and shoved them under the coals of the fire to incinerate. The moon was down, leaving nothing but the starry sky for illumination. It occurred to him that he had never seen a night this dark. Even on the road with the caravan, there had always been lights left burning as a matter of caution. Back home in Haven, the palace was always lit, even late at night, and there were lights in the garden, the stables, and on the pathways. Here and now, there was only the subdued glowing of the coals under a thickening coating of ash. He didn't remember ever seeing so many stars. And as he had noted before, the nighttime forest was scarcely quiet. From their vantage point atop the bluff, he heard the splash of animals drinking or crossing the river, the calls of owls and night birds, the song of insects. In a lot of ways, this was good. As long as that chorus kept up, there was very little chance of anything sneaking up on them without the night creatures seeing or hearing it, and the chorus would go silent. It was very peaceful, even if he knew that the piece was deceptive, and very beautiful. But the fascination could only hold for so long. Eventually, he felt his head bobbing, and he poked his father to take his turn. He lay down again and didn't wake until the smell of cooking hare tickled him awake.
"Maybe I should have asked to borrow one of those ravens for a little while," he admitted, as they saddled up for another day on the road. "It would be useful to have eyes in the sky."
"But you can use regular birds for that," his father reminded him. "No, I think you did the right thing. It's better for them to feel gracious about helping us, not grudging."
It was pretty obvious as they moved on toward the inn that was their goal that the landscape had become hillier, much hillier. Just for the sake of practice, whenever Perry caught sight of a bird soaring overhead, he made an effort to see through its eyes. Mostly these were ordinary hawks and vultures, using the thermals to stay aloft with as little effort as possible. In the distance, he caught sight of what might have been buildings of tiny villages or small holdings now and again, but there was nothing near the road, which seemed odd.
"Laurel, why aren't people living near the road?"
he asked.
"Because the road is where strangers are," came the reply with overtones of eating.
Laurel must have paused to catch something for a meal. He was a really big creature. He probably had to make a lot of small, rabbit-sized meals over the course of the day.
"Most people out here are suspicious of strangers, except in the bigger villages. Otherwise, They will have a single person in the group, usually a large, strong man who is designated to make contact with others.
He turned that over in his mind. Surely they need things after a while.
Not as often as you might think. They often have their own small mills to grind their own flour. They make most of their clothing from leather, and when they do need something, that single person will make a journey to a bigger village to trade for it. Or traders know where these small holdings are and will come to them. If you were really traders, you would have gotten a more detailed map showing where they were, and you would be off the road fairly often.
It seemed a strange and very hard way to live.
The food must be awfully monotonous. Tell your father I am looking for a campsite now,
Laurel said out of nowhere.
I think it is going to rain, and heavily. Your little clothes won't keep that off. I will need to find a cave or enlarge a burrow.
Father! Perry called, but softly. Something about the heavy silence, broken only by distant bird calls, made him want to keep from attracting anything's attention.
Laurel thinks it's going to rain badly. He's looking for a campsite, like a cave.
Mags looked over his shoulder and nodded.
I'll have Dolan help,
he replied, and he held Lily back so he was riding side by side with Perry.
If it's going to rain, there are a lot of considerations when picking a site,
he continued in a low conversational voice, as if he, like Perry, was reluctant to let his words carry past the road.
We don't want something under a tree at the top of a hill because of lightning strikes. We don't want something in the valley because of floods. It would be nice if we could find a big dry cave large enough to fit us all, including the horses, but the horses won't melt if we can't get them into shelter.
Laurel and Dolan do have a reasonably good chance of finding something suitable, though, even if Laurel has to enlarge a badger burrow or something of the sort.
That's what he said, Perry agreed.
Look around us, Mags continued. This is actually good territory to find a cave in. He gestured at an enormous rock outcropping they were passing by.
The only trick will be finding something that water won't be pouring into once the rain starts.
As the day drew on, Perry started feeling increasingly worried that they weren't going to find anything suitable. Could they beg shelter in someone's barn, or would they be met with weapons and suspicion? But just as he was about to suggest that, Laurel spoke up again.
I have something perfect. It's big enough for all of us, and it should not get wet inside. Dolan is waiting by the road to guide you.
Dolan already told me, his father said, giving Lily a nudge with his heels to send her into a trot. Just in good time, I think.
It was with great relief, because now clouds were gathering overhead, that he spotted Dolan a few more turns down the road. It was with even more relief that he heard Laurel add,
And I caught you dinner.
You're amazing, he told Laurel.
Of course I am, Laurel replied. Tell your father to hurry up. I smell the rain.
9.
I'll get wood, you get fodder, said Mags as they shooed the horses into the cave and left Dolan to keep them there.
Perry grabbed the little hand scythe from where it was stored on the outside of his left-hand pack and ran out to the sound of distant, growling thunder. He began gathering and cutting the lush, waist-high meadow grass below the cave as fast as he could manage, bringing back as much as he could carry and dumping it in front of the horses before running back out again. Now he could smell the rain, too, and the thunder was getting closer. Twice he passed Laurel, dragging a huge branch up to the cave. Too bad Laurel was of no help whatsoever with the fodder. They had just about enough time to gather a fair amount of wood for a fire and a good, tall pile of grass for the horses to eat when the rain started. In fact, Perry was bringing in what he thought might be the last giant armload of grass when a bolt of lightning struck somewhere far too close, making him jump and shriek. Fortunately, the barrage of thunder that pummeled them at the same time as the lightning strike masked his outburst, or he'd have felt horribly embarrassed by the girlish scream that had just emerged from his mouth. But as if that lightning had literally split the clouds, the downpour began immediately, and he was soaked in moments as he scuttled the last few paces to safety and protection. The good thing was that instead of sloping down into the cave floor sloped up into the cave, meaning it was unlikely they were going to get wet tonight. The bad thing was that the floor was stone, and besides sloping up, it was also tilted at a slight sideways angle. Perry could see it was going to be really hard to find a comfortable place to sleep tonight.
Oh well.
He dropped his last huge armload of grass on the pile the horses were already muzzle deep into. His father had positioned the pile at the back of the cave so that their fire was going to be between the horses and the entrance to the cave. That, Mags had explained, was so that they'd be unlikely to bolt out into the storm if they were spooked. His father had already taken their tack off and piled it to one side, bringing the packs to the fire. Perry wiped the horses down with a handful of grass, checked to make sure they weren't thirsty, and joined his father at the fire. Supper was apparently going to be hare again, though Mags had dug into their supplies to augment it with something else. What? Perry wasn't sure yet. Laurel had been very busy. There were 6 fat hares piled up, and Mags was working on the 7th.
One good thing,
his father observed, looking at the veritable waterfall cascading off the rocks overhead, down onto the stone at the mouth of the cave and pouring down into the valley.
We don't have to go far for water.
Then he turned a crooked smile on Perry.
Beginning to regret coming out here?
Perry shook his head. We're dry. At least I will be in a little bit. And we have a dry place to sleep and food to eat. We're good. Could be lots worse.
And it's not snowing, Mags chuckled. The last cave I was stuck in, we were snowed into for a moon. We were lucky we had the caravan with us. If we hadn't, there might have been issues getting the horses and companions fed.
The same caravan we have now?
Perry asked.
The same. I'll tell you about some of it tonight if you like. Not all of it. There's a lot to tell.
Since Mags didn't often tell stories out of his past, Perry felt a surge of excitement.
That would be terrific,
he said with unfeigned enthusiasm.
Be careful what you wish for, Mags cautioned with a chuckle. It might be boring.
Finally, Perry saw what he was doing, making tea by dropping heated rocks into the leather bucket, which had a couple of mugs worth of water and a bundle of dried herbs in it.
That'll be good about now,
he thought, shivering.
He was drying off, but the wind that had brought the storm was cold, and the rock floor of the cave was pretty chilly, too.
The good thing about a storm like this is that nothing is going to move in it, said Laurel,
who was lying next to the fire, head on paws, nose twitching a little.
We shall all be able to sleep tonight.
You think this storm is going to last the night?
Perry asked aloud.
And past sunrise, Laurel confirmed.
Like it is now?
Perry asked in surprise, staring at the torrent of water outside. He could not imagine a storm raging all night this hard. Near-constant lightning did strange things to the cascade at the entrance, seeming to freeze the water in mid-fall, and the thunder was an ever-present low growl.
Probably not, but enough that any creature that is not forced to be out in it probably will choose staying where it is.
His father handed him the bucket after fishing out the little bundle of herbs. He took it, shivering a little, and drank the hot, minty liquid gratefully. He shivered as he began to warm up again. He passed the bucket back to his father, who drank the rest and picked out the stones to use again, then divided the now cooked hare.
Well, Mag said at last, it was when we were still worried about the sleep givers, who wanted me back in their hands, right after I escaped from them. I told you a little about them.
Perry nodded.
His father had told him just enough to make him horribly curious, but he had understood instinctively that Mags really didn't want to talk about that particular passage in his life, so instead, he went to Lord Jorthon, who had sat him down with a hand-bound and handwritten book and the instructions that it was never to leave the library. Everything that anyone knew about the Sleepgivers was in there. All of it had been pried out of his father's skull by skilled mind-speakers. And how those memories had gotten there in the first place. It had been very strange reading.
Well, we were all still worried that they'd come after me again. Turned out we were right, but that came later. So the Dean and your grandfather and Lord Jorthon hatched a plan to send me and Harold Jakir out on the sort of 2-year mentorship that was the way they did things before there was a Harold's Collegium. And to make sure that my friends couldn't be used against me again, they sent Bear and Lena and Amelie out ahead of me with Bard Leda in the caravan. Jakir and I doubled back and met them on the road. I have to say that, if we hadn't been so worried about the Sleepgivers, it would have been a lot of fun, but I was pretty happy to see the old caravan again.
I can't see how 6 of you managed, especially over winter,
Perry shook his head.
How did you keep from clawing each other's throats out?
Mags laughed at that. We used way stations most of the time, of course. Some of us in the caravan, the rest in the way station. And when winter came, we were living in a cave complex that had once been used by bandits. The guards stocked it for the winter before we got there, so supplies weren't a problem. But when we first went out, just after harvest fair, the weather was mostly good. And if it hadn't been for Jakir and Lita sniping at each other, it would have been about the most perfect trip you could imagine.
I don't know. I think our trip has been pretty perfect. And we don't have to share the caravan with four other people,
Perry pointed out. His father laughed and ruffled his hair, but he said nothing. It was full dark by then, or rather it would have been if there hadn't been so much lightning. Perry watched the storm in fascination. Despite the fact that they were technically in shelter, he had never been so aware of the sheer power and ferocity of a storm. It was one thing to be inside a multi-story stone building with weather raging outside. You could shut the window, pull the curtains closed, and retreat to the fire. It was quite another to have the storm mere arm lengths from you, with no way to close it out. Suddenly, Lily stirred. And Perry knew why immediately.
Oh, no you don't,
he exclaimed, jumped to his feet, and got her and Daisy and Pog for good measure, led them to the rain-splattered opening of the cave, and backed them up to it. Just in time. First, Lily, and then, as if she had triggered them, Pog and Daisy emptied themselves out. And the mess was immediately sluiced away by the waterfall.
Hmm.
Mags eyed the horses, then the slanting floor, then the horses again.
I think we need to reconsider our stabling arrangements.
He looked at Dallin. Dallin stared back for a while.
Dallin wants to know if you'll move the fodder. He'll show you where.
For an answer, Perry led the horses over to where Dallin moved, then brought the drying grass to them, armload by armload, until it was all piled up. This was at the side of the cave, at the lowest point of the side-to-side slant. So at least if the horses let loose with another bout, it would all be over on that side, away from where they were sleeping. Mag sighed.
Hazards of traveling with horses instead of companions.
Dallin says he'll keep them from wandering off if the rain stops while we're sleeping.
Laurel says it won't,
Perry replied, looking to Laurel for confirmation, only to see that Laurel was sleeping heavily. He looped the lead ropes over each horse's back and left the long-suffering Dallin in charge of them.
I'm gonna see if there's anything in the back of this cave we can use under our blankets.
There wasn't anything. So he made a pillow out of his pack, folded his cloak under the blankets, and made himself as comfortable as he could. Eventually, with some wiggling, he found a sort of shallow depression that fit him tolerably well, and finally fell asleep. It didn't last nearly as long as he would have liked. First, the arm under his pack fell asleep, and when a violent boom of thunder jarred him awake, he had to endure a passage of very uncomfortable pins and needles before he could fall asleep again. Then his hip began to hurt, so he turned over to his other side. Then the other hip began to hurt. In fact, he started to feel bruised all over. He rolled over onto his back, but that didn't work either. Rock was turning out to be awfully unforgiving to sleep on. In fact, it wasn't until Laurel took pity on him and curled around him for some extra support that he was actually able to find a comfortable position for the rest of the night. At some point while he was asleep, the rain slacked off. The thunder that had troubled his dreams faded off into the distance, and the worst of the storm was over. When he woke at about dawn, unspeakably grateful for Laurel's help overnight, the waterfall at the entrance to the cave had turned into something more like a delicate bead curtain. He got up, a bit painfully, and walked over to the entrance. The stream that had been a mere trickle last night was a torrent now. He examined the raging stream carefully. Or at least as much of it as he could see from here. There was a spot almost immediately below where he was standing, where the water welled up. He thought he remembered there being a massive tree trunk crossing what had then been a serene little brook. The water had flowed under it last night, so the fact that the stream had overtopped that log gave a pretty good measure of just how much was flowing now.
As small as that stream was last night, I can hardly believe what it looks like. It could easily drown someone who fell into it now.
Perry looked up at his father, who was staring down at the stream himself.
Didn't you rescue Grandfather out of that river back home?
He asked.
Yes. And a girl who...
fell into it a year or so after that, Mags agreed.
By that moment of hesitation, Perry sensed that there was a lot his father wasn't telling him about that second incident, but he knew better than to ask about it. The king's spy held a lot of secrets. Not all of them were to do with protecting the kingdom.
And not all of them are his to give away either. Not even to me.
But that's the place I'd aim for if I had to rescue someone again, Mags continued, pointing at the submerged log. I'd catch her there, where the log can hold us both against the current. Hold her head up out of the water and wait for more help to pull us out.
Perry frowned a little, staring downslope at the place, picturing it in his mind. Then, without warning, he was there, in the stream, tumbling helplessly in the current, struggling to breathe, struggling to get his head above the water long enough to get a breath, battered, bruised, and panicking.
Mama!
He cried.
Mama!
And yet, it wasn't him, and he ran through the tall, wet grass, slipping and catching himself, even as he felt his body tumbling into the stream. The log. He had to get to the log. Then, as he was halfway down the slope to the log, he realized that it wasn't him. It was some young thing in the water upstream, fighting to stay alive. He snapped out of his running trance and focused on where he was, what he needed to do. The creature he had to rescue was close. Close enough for him to hear it cry in his mind. And like the ravens, this creature was not human, or he never would have heard it.
Perry!
Laurel barked in his mind.
Here!
He glanced to the side to see that Laurel was running beside him, a coil of their rope in his mouth. They both skidded to a halt on the bank. He grabbed the dangling end of the rope and fastened it around his waist, while Laurel ran three times around a tree trunk with the other end, then braced himself and nodded. Then Perry was slipping off the bank into the icy water that hit him like a runaway cart. He didn't try to fight the current. Instead, he put his back to the tree trunk and inched carefully along it, getting the current to help him, with the water pinning him to the log until he was in the middle of the stream, waiting, and hearing those cries of,
Mama! Mama!
Growing nearer and weaker. The water was just about up to his throat, like a huge hand against his chest, shoving him against the smooth wood. A weaker current tugged at his legs. He knew he should have been terrified, but somehow he wasn't. Maybe that was only because he hadn't inhaled any water yet. He vaguely made out sounds that might have been his father shouting from the bank, but even though Mags couldn't be more than a couple of arms' lengths away, all Perry could really hear was the water rushing around him. But the rope at his waist tightened up, and he knew by that sign that his father had taken it over from Laurel. It wasn't pulling at him. It was just a reminder that he had an anchor point. The stream ran down a slight slope toward him, and at the edge of his vision, he caught sight of something. Something tossing, cream and tan, on the surface of the flood. And with it came a weak, mental,
Mama!
Laurel! It's coming! Here it comes!
He shifted a little, gulped water as the flood smacked his face, snorted it out of his nose, and braced himself with his arms out.
The creature hit him. Briefly, he ducked under the water. The breath got knocked out of him, and he had no idea how he kept the presence of mind to grab for the object before it tumbled over his head, over the log, and downstream out of reach. But catch it he did. And when he fought his way up to the surface again, got his legs under him, and got a breath, he saw he'd caught some sort of delicate fawn creature, about half the size of Laurel, both arms around the chest. Right side up, thank the gods, or he wasn't sure how he'd have been able to get her turned around again. With a grunt and a wrench, he got a hand under her chin and forced her head above the water, hoping she was still breathing.
And now what do I do?
Now he was trying to hold this heavy thing in his arms. He couldn't fight his way along the log without losing his balance, the creature, or both. But he couldn't stay there either. Trying to hold against the flood, his arms were going to get tired sooner rather than later, and he'd lose her anyway. And worse still, there was plenty of current running under that log as well as over it. If he slipped and fell, he'd lose her and he'd get sucked under, maybe wedged under the log and die if there wasn't enough room for him to fit under there. Now fear hit him. All he thought about was getting down here and rescuing this creature.
Bloody hell, he thought in dismay. Now what do I do?
Laurel,
he cried.
Is there any way you can help me?
But it wasn't Laurel that answered him.
Hold fast a little longer, boy,
A mind voice thundered into his, sounding like a warrior in a play.
We're coming!
Mama!
Bleated the fawn in his arms, easing the fear he had that she was already gone.
She's coming! Keep breathing! Help me keep your head up!
He ordered, and he felt the fawn straining her head and neck, getting her nose a little higher above the roiling stream. Then, down the slope they thundered. An entire herd of creatures, an avalanche of backs and horns and glimpses of bright black eyes. They poured into the path of the stream 3 and 4 and 5 deep, bracing against it, until they formed a wedge of flesh and bone that diverted enough of the torrent into the meadow that he was able, with his father keeping the rope around his waist height, to scrape along the tree, and then heave the fawn up onto the bank, where she staggered a few paces and dropped to her knees. Then Mags had him under the arms and pulled him up on the bank as well, and the living dam lurched ashore on the other side of the stream, and the tree trunk was engulfed again.
Oh, gods! Oh, gods!
Perry lay beside the fawn, coughing and panting. What he assumed was the fawn's mother pelted toward them from the herd, skidded to a halt on the wet grass next to him, and began licking and comforting her terrified and exhausted child. He began to shiver, until Laurel nudged him into a sitting position and curled up around him. He collapsed against Laurel's shoulder and hugged the Kyrie, in gratitude as well as for warmth. Then the part of the herd that was still on this bank ambled over to join them. He was too tired to do more than fill his aching lungs over and over again with the blessed air, but after a while, he began to feel warm again and looked up. His father and Dalin were standing practically nose to nose with one of these creatures, a really big one, whose head, unlike the fawn's, was crowned with a pair of spiraling straight horns that ended in very wicked points. He glanced back over at the fawn who'd gotten shakily to her feet and was pressed into her mother's flank.
Are you going to be all right, little one? He asked gently.
She stared at him with big, still frightened eyes.
Yes?
She said tentatively. Her mother nuzzled her and then looked right at him.
If it were not for you...
He felt something blow into his hair, a strong, hot breath that smelled pleasantly of hay. Startled, he craned his neck around to find himself eye to muzzle with the big stag his father had been talking to.
Well done, lad. If not for you, she wouldn't have lasted much longer. She slipped off the bank at a slippery spot, and we couldn't keep up with her.
Perry could not help but notice the sheer, controlled power of that mind voice. In fact, he was getting the impression that if this creature cared to, he could control all of them without a second thought. And in immediate answer to that, the stag snorted the tiniest bit.
Of course I could, lad. I am a king stag of the Vaihili. I control the herd. I take it you have never seen us before.
I've never been this far out of Haven before, he replied, eyes widening.
Are you... And here he paused, because he had the feeling that if he said, like bond birds, this creature would be insulted.
We are the allies of the Taledras, like the Tervardi and the Hertasi, more like the Tervardi. I cannot picture any of us serving as the Hertasi do.
Me either.
That seemed to amuse the Daihili no end.
I see Roya has introduced himself to you, Mags said, interrupting the stag's amusement.
Perry, that was excellent thinking on your part.
I'm very glad you went to the rescue. I'd have done the same if I'd have been able to hear the fawn's cry for help.
Then we must all be grateful that your son could,
Roya said, and there was an odd overtone to his mind voice that made Perry think he might be mind-speaking at both the level where Perry could hear him and the level where mind-speaking humans could hear him. Or was he actually strong enough that he could make even humans who weren't mind-speakers hear him, like Max?
Why, yes, I am. That is why I am the King's Stag.
Max stood at the mouth of the cave with Roya and Dalin at his side. It was still drizzling, but the Daihili didn't seem to care. Now that the fawn was back with the herd and her mother, all was right with their world, and they were feasting on the lush water meadow grass. Behind him, Laurel was curled up around Perry. Mags had made Perry some hot tea, and he was wrapped in a blanket while his clothing dried over the fire. There was a sea of cream and tan backs below the mouth of the cave. Among the cream and tan were three darker backs belonging to Lily, Daisy, and Pog. Roya had assured him that the horses would neither spook nor stray, and Mags saw no reason to disbelieve him. The rescue had all happened too fast for him to feel any terror for his son until after it was all over. Now, he could envisage everything that could have gone wrong. At the time, all he had been able to do was to frantically get through each moment, and then the next, with no room for fear. Roya stood beside him, gazing down at his herd.
"We are in your debt, of course,"
the Daihili said, meditatively.
"But since neither you nor we are likely to be here for much longer, I am unsure how to repay you."
"I hope you mean that in the sense of both of us going on our ways, rather than a portent of doom," he said aloud.
Dallin snickered. Roya snorted.
"We are not inclined to philosophy. We leave that to creatures that need such things."
"I don't suppose you've heard anything about something attacking lone travelers hereabouts?"
he asked without much hope.
"A dangerous beast? Bandits of some sort?"
"We have not been here in these parts long enough to have heard anything, and our numbers would preclude any creature or human of that nature attacking us,"
Roya pointed out logically.
"Your offspring is asleep."
Mags looked over his shoulder. Perry was indeed asleep, half curled up on the Kyrie.
"He is a good and brave child, and with an odd gift that proved the salvation of my offspring."
"A bit impulsive about jumping in to help," Mags replied. "This is the second time he's done that in the last few days."
"You do not approve?"
"I'm not sure what to think. Both times it was warranted. Absolutely necessary, in fact. I would have done the same. Both times everything turned out fine."
He let his voice trail off, sure that Roya would fill in what he had not said.
"But what if it hadn't?"
"Exactly," he sighed. "This trip of ours was supposed to be a sort of testing time for him. Now I'm having second thoughts about that. Is he exercising enough caution? I don't know."
"Well, if it is any comfort, at least this time, he would have had to be stronger than me to have resisted the call,"
Roya said apologetically.
"I was summoning, trying to find another herd downstream that could block the water and save the fawn, or perhaps Hertasi that could have jumped in to the rescue. It was nonspecific, and I think he was caught in it."
For one very short moment, anger flared in him. But a moment later, he had tamped it down. Roya was a father, after all, just as he was. If it had been one of his children tumbling in those floodwaters, what would he have done?
Set a wide net for help and not worry about who got caught in it, just like he did.
"Being a parent isn't very easy," he said ruefully, voicing aloud a thing that had been festering in him since he first set his eyes on Perry, newborn.
"No one gives you any instructions. They all just tell you you'll be fine, as if it was something that was as instinctive as a bird flying south for the winter."
For a brief second, he actually sensed Roya riffling effortlessly through his memories, quite as if he had absolutely no barriers in place.
"Yes, I can see. It would be particularly difficult for you, who have no memories of your sire and dam. But you balance your lack of personal example by observing those around you and selecting what seems best. I believe, insofar as it is possible for me to judge, you are doing well. And if you doubt me, look to your son, who has twice saved others."
The sheer strength of the Daihili's mind would have terrified him if he let himself think about it. The only thing that tempered his reaction was Roya's attitude. The king's stag really did not give a damn about what he found in a human's mind. He wasn't interested in using it, except as information in the moment. He didn't care about human secrets or human foibles, or human sins. It was the utter indifference, in the end, that made it all palatable. Roya made a huffing sound.
"This strength of mind is the gift that was given to the king's stags for the defense and prosperity of the herd. We were prey animals. We still would be if not for this. The king's stag must be able to control the entire herd, to direct them against the things that would kill us, and do so with absolute surety. He must be able to use his mind as a weapon against our foes, and should the king's stag fall,
The chief doe must have the same strength of will and mind. But your thoughts and memories are of very little interest to me.
I suppose not. He was more amused than insulted. I probably seem pretty silly to you.
Not at all, actually. I had heard of you, Harold. I doubted that you were half so altruistic as you were painted. I was wrong.
The Dahili gave him a penetrating look out of his near eye.
I am glad our lands are neighbors.
Mags didn't know quite how to respond to that, so he remained silent, surrounded by the sound of the gentle rain and the steady tearing and munching of grass.
I think, said Roya,
when they had both been contemplating the herd for quite some time,
that we will remain here for a season. I was going to take us farther north and west, but it would be a shame not to make use of these water meadows, and we can easily share them with the deer here, as they seem few.
That might be because of the pack of Slytha that attacked the ravens, Mags observed.
All the more reason to stay,
Roya replied, with a calm that made his next words seem all the more bloodthirsty.
The sooner we can find them and trample them into compost, the better.
Mags gave the king's stag a sideways look. Roya snorted.
It is what we were created to do,
he said, as if this were common knowledge. He said it with such conviction that Mags was taken aback. He was as certain as if the god of the Dahili, whatever that was, had come down and declared it to him, which was, again, disturbing. Was he dealing with a cult of sorts? A four-legged fanatic? Roya began to make a wheezing sound. It took Mags a moment to realize the Dahili was laughing. What's so funny? He asked testily.
Your mistake. Our creator was not some god. Our creator was a human mage. We know this. We carry the memory and share it with our descendants. We were created for war, as the griffins were created for war. We make war on the lesser creatures of evil. The Wersa, the Slytha, they make war on the greater. Although we are centuries from that time, we have never forgotten this.
Mags turned to stare at him. You really remember that? How is that even possible?
You shared the memories of your father's people. How is that possible?
Mags was left unable to retort, because he still didn't understand how the sleep givers that had taken him captive had flooded him not with their personal memories, but with what seemed to be memories going back hundreds of years. Those memories had been intended to turn him from what he was into a sleep giver like them. Thanks to Dalin, it hadn't worked. Roya waited in silence for a while longer, then blew out his breath in a long snort.
Since you are either exceedingly polite or unbelievably dense, what I'm saying is that the herd and I will probably be here if, for some reason, you need assistance with your mystery. You most likely will not, but you are far from home. Assistance will be difficult to come by. We owe you more than empty gratitude, and we're not just a herd of silly cattle.
Oh, Mags replied, taken off guard by the offer. Thank you. Actually, you're right on all counts. I feel better knowing you're out here, just in case.
Good.
Roya appeared to accept that as a sort of deal.
I am going to eat. I suggest you and the boy remain here overnight to make sure he hasn't taken any harm from his adventure. In fact, you ought to take the time to make better, more comfortable beds and get some rest yourself.
Roya didn't wait for an answer. He trotted down into the field and soon was lost in it, visible only by the length of his horns. I know where there's a big patch of bracken, and some of it may actually be dry, Dalin offered. Follow me, and we'll get enough that both of you can have a decent night tonight. Mags got the little hand scythe and some light rope and followed Dalin out and along the slope of the hill. Sure enough, well in under some trees, there was a nice big patch of bracken, and many of the fronds were young and tender enough to eat. He gathered plenty of those first. Then he cut plenty for two thick mats, bound it up with the light rope, and Dalin towed it back. He made up two beds, picked Perry up, and bundled him into the smaller one. Laurel stood up, shook himself, and looked Mags in the eye.
Ryron,
he said with dignity, and padded out of the cave. With Perry sound asleep,
the entire Daihili herd between them and potential trouble, and Laurel taking care of their food, there seemed no good reason not to follow Roya's advice. Last night had definitely not been an easy one for sleeping, and the warm fire, the sound of the rain, and the much softer bed lured him into the slumber that had eluded him, and not even his worries about Perry kept him from it. 10. Mags and his son had scrambled up into the protective canopy of a tree to view their target from across the cleared area around it. Mags peered carefully through the foliage, being careful not to disturb it. Perry, however, was wedged in a crotch, eyes closed, concentrating. So, here was the inn they'd be aiming for, and it looked perfectly ordinary. Not as big as the weary traveler, it was still impressive enough, since it was protected by a palisade of tree trunks with sharpened tops and had a stout gate. This place looked as if it could hold off pretty much anything short of a small army. Of course, that was to be expected out here. Also to be expected would be that gate closing at sunset, because no one in his right mind went traipsing through thick woods like this after sunset, even if there was a road. That it had a couple of guards outside the gate was a bit of a surprise. Mags wouldn't have thought that an inn this far out got enough custom to pay for the hire of two guards. Then again, there was a certain family resemblance to them. They might be a couple of sons or nephews, rather than hired guards. The forest had been cleared away from the inn for a couple of furlongs in every direction, leaving a sea of stumps which would inevitably handicap a rush to storm the walls or the gate. This did make it a little harder to survey the place without being seen, but only a little, with Perry along. They had left the horses hidden off the road with Laurel watching them. Dalin was almost directly below them, somehow managing to be invisible despite the fact that he was a blinding white. If anything went amiss, Dalin could carry them both and run faster than any pursuer, even carrying double.
"Two guards inside the gates," Perry muttered. "But they're lounging about right outside the front door of the inn and drinking. There might be more inside the inn. There's a stable, too. I haven't looked in there yet."
Well, that sounded very like the guards were actually relatives.
"All right. Inside the stable now. There's one very young man mending a halter. I think he's what passes for the chief stableman. There's 5 horses in the stable. 2 of them are cart horses. The other 3 are riding horses. There's chickens and some goats. I'm looking for an animal inside the inn now."
A moment later, Perry spoke again.
"I found a cat. There are 3 guests. They're all men and look very tough. There is 1 serving girl and a bartender. They look alike."
He paused, presumably walking the cat around.
"There is 1 cook and 2 more girls in the kitchen. Should I look upstairs?"
"Not right now. You can come back."
Perry opened his eyes immediately.
"Well? What are we going to do?"
"Move closer. Camp in the forest close enough that you can use the cat to eavesdrop on people tonight," Mags decided. "We'd rather feel foolish for taking a lot of precautions we didn't need to than find ourselves in trouble."
"I'm sure Roya would approve,"
his son replied, smiling up at him.
"I hope so. We'd hate to have to explain to him that we needed the herd's help because we were stupidly overconfident."
He glanced down at the ground beneath the tree.
"Speaking of overconfidence, let's take no chances this close to the inn."
Perry nodded and followed his father as they traced their path back to where they had left the horses, never once putting foot on the ground. According to the information Mags had read, this was how the Hawk brothers traveled too, moving from tree to tree, undetectable and mysterious to those on the ground. Well, a lifetime of wall climbing and roof walking had prepared him well enough to follow their example, and Perry, who had the twin advantages of not having been starved from infancy and having been trained to climb almost as soon as he began walking, was even better at it. Of course, it also helped that Perry was a third of Mags's weight, if that. Up here in the branches, Mags followed Perry's lead, rather than the other way around. The farther they got from the inn, the better Mags felt. Of course, he could have used his own gift of mind speech to skim over the thoughts of those within that palisade, but no. True, the odds were heavily against another mind speaker being in there, but with so many people missing and no burning time candle counting down the marks to some calamity, well, he was going to err strongly on the side of caution.
It was measurably darker beneath the trees when they finally came out next to the horses and Laurel. The Kyrie looked from one to the other of them. Mags shrugged and asked the obvious.
Parry, can you reach the inn animals from here?
Instead of answering immediately, Parry sat right down on the ground so he could put all his concentration into his gift. Mags waited patiently. It occurred to him that they had never yet tested the limits of Parry's ability when it came to distance. There would be a limit, of course, and that limit might depend on whether or not he had contacted a particular animal's mind before.
If we have to move close, we'll do it, he told himself. But I have to admit I'd be relieved.
I'd rather be lying down, but...
Yes, Parry spoke up, just as he was thinking that.
The cat. I can reach the cat. I might be able to find a bat or an owl and fly it there, too.
Good. That's excellent news. Let's find a secure place to camp now.
Their food needs were taken care of, thanks to all of them hunting, and the humans doing some gathering along the way. Laurel quickly found a perfect location, a grove of evergreens growing against a rocky outcrop. Their branches reached all the way down to the ground, which would make it hard for anything to force its way in toward them. There was just enough room for all of them once they worked their way along the rock face to a clearing, and there was just enough grass in the clearing to keep the horses satisfied. Mags made a tiny fire, just big enough to roast their catches over the coals, while Parry piled long evergreen needles into a couple of beds. As the sky darkened, they quickly ate, and Parry settled into his bedroll while Mags stood guard. Birds began coming into what was probably their nightly roost here. Parry took a moment to reassure them, and they settled right in. Mags approved. They'd make a good sort of lookout. Anything that tried to make its way in here would disturb them. It was a little surreal, because the very few times as a child when he had felt even relative contentment had been on summer nights like this one. When he and the others had been released from the sluices, they'd been free to scavenge the forest around the mine for anything edible, and he generally found something, giving him the rare treat of a full stomach. And before he had to go back to the mine, to the noisome pit where all the mine slaves slept, he'd scrape together a couch of pine needles and lie back, looking up through the boughs at the stars. He could never have imagined his life now. If he'd been asked, he probably would have said he expected to be dead before he saw 2 decades. Parry began to speak, quietly, and he shook off his mordant thoughts to listen. It had been a lot easier to slip into the mind of the cat when he was lying down, and the cat, for her part, seemed to welcome him there. He found her in the kitchen, but she was quite willing to move into the common room when he asked her to. One hearth was as good as another to her, and she was less likely to be tripped over in the common room.
"Bullocks,"
said one of the 3 men who had been in the common room the last time Parry had seen it through the eyes of the cat.
"It'll be thin pickings until harvest, and if we get anything at all, I'll be gobsmacked."
His expression was oddly melancholy, as if he had found himself in a life he didn't much like, but didn't know how to change.
"You'd rather be back there for the summer?"
asked the second. The first shook his head vehemently.
"Bugger me, no!"
He shivered.
"Me neither,"
said the 3rd man.
"I'd rather be on half pay here than full pay back there. I'll keep waiting to find him, crawling around inside my skull, and waking up balmy.
That makes 2 of us.
The 1st man sipped carefully at his beer. That was when Parry noticed something odd. These 3 men, who, presumably from their physiques and weapons, were fighters of some sort, were not acting like fighting men on their own in a tavern. They had finished eating what looked like a plain, though probably filling, meal. The cat's sensitive nose picked up pea porridge flavored with bacon and bread and butter. They had pushed their empty bowls aside and were carefully nursing their tankards of beer, as if they anticipated having to make the single tankard last for the evening. This was very different behavior from the 2 men he'd observed earlier in the yard just outside the inn. Those 2 had swilled beer as if there were no bottom to the barrel. They'd also seemed much more relaxed than these 3. Just to be sure, he walked the cat out the door to see if any of the 4 he'd noticed before were there now. The gate was closed, and the 2 he'd seen drinking before were now pacing the wall. So, they were night guards. And yet, unless they had sobered up since the last time he'd watched them, they had to be tipsy. Night guards with no one around to hold them accountable. which was not the behavior of the three men inside. He murmured all this to his father. Maybe Mags could make something of this. He was a little too busy negotiating with the cat to have time to think about what their behavior meant. He sent the cat back inside, then padding up the stairs to what he suspected was the common sleeping room. Sure enough, there were the two gate guards from earlier, already sound asleep and smelling of more beer. The sleeping room was one big room, as was not uncommon in smaller, more remote, or cheaper inns, and in most cases, guests were expected to supply their own sleeping rolls. There were 7 sleeping places laid out with belongings here. 2 were occupied. Presumably the bartender, the cook, and the girls slept elsewhere, downstairs perhaps. Maybe the 4 gate guards were related, and actually were the ones supposed to be keeping an eye on the place, rather than the bartender being in charge. That would account for why they felt free to drink. The girls probably slept in the kitchen, and the boy he had seen earlier in the stable would sleep there among the horses. And that accounted for all the people attached to the inn. He sent the cat back downstairs. The 3 fighters were still having a desultory conversation.
"Get out,"
the 3rd man was saying.
"Take my money. Find a warm place down south. Do anything but this. Plenty of work busting heads in taverns."
He hunched over, eyes glancing everywhere, and whispered hoarsely,
"Don't tell me you ain't thinking the same. I ain't made enough to leave yet,"
the 1st admitted.
"Well, don't mind telling you, I'm thinking about it, though. It'd have to be leave taken from here. If we tried from there, aye."
The man took a tiny sip of his beer.
"Gives me the shivers, that place does."
They all subsided into morose silence. The cat lounged on the hearth, but not one word more did he hear out of them until the last of the beer was gone and they slumped up the stairs to bed. The cat yawned and asked him if there was anything else he wanted to see. He had reported every word to his father, and after trotting the cat around to every place he could get it to go, there was no one else talking. With the exception of the night guards, everyone was asleep. The girls on the kitchen hearth, the boy in the hay in the stables, the cook and the bartender together in a little cubby off the kitchen. With disappointment, he left the cat to her own devices and came back to himself.
"Well, that was frustrating,"
his father said softly. Perry got himself up on his elbows. His father was sitting on his own bedroll, the tiny fire between them and moonlight pouring down on them. The trees were full of sleepy birds. He heard them twittering and muttering to themselves.
"Aye," he said, sitting up slowly. "I wish they'd talked more. There was just enough there to sound interesting, but not enough to sound like it's more than just being unhappy with whoever has hired them."
"I didn't want to do this,"
Mag said slowly.
"We think we'll have to play bait so we can get close enough to glean things from their unguarded thoughts. Or I will, by myself. I don't think—"
"I'd make better bait if they're going after easy prey,"
Perry pointed out, suppressing alarm at the idea that his father was going to walk into danger alone.
"Under no circumstances are you going to go in there alone,"
Mag snapped, reflexively, then seemed to catch himself.
"Obviously, neither of us wants the other to go in alone. But if we go in together, we'll need to have every last possibility planned for. We can't chance any sort of slip, because if they catch one of us, they'll have both of us."
He sat quietly for a moment.
"We have to assume the entire inn is a trap, that everyone working there is in on whatever this is. So, we need witnesses, so they won't try to spring the trap on us while we're actually inside. Which means we need to wait until there is a party too big for them to take already there when we make ourselves known."
"That could take a while," Perry noted. "But that's what we're out here for, right?"
Mags patted his head. Perry decided that now was not the time to point out how that annoyed him.
"It'll give us a chance to work out everything we need to do, including set up our escape route."
It sounded as though he was prepared to start the planning right there and then. But Laurel interrupted him with a huge yawn followed by a snort, and he laughed.
"And it can all wait until morning."
"And I can keep listening in on them too, Father," Perry pointed out. "Every night. Maybe they'll drop something else, and we won't have to do this."
"So that's 2 plans. One will almost certainly work out. Meanwhile, our first job in the morning should be to either find a better place than this for a camp, or make this into a better, more comfortable and secure camp."
He sighed.
"And I'm babbling. Get some sleep, Perry, and I'll do the same. We'll make real plans in the morning. It took them no more than the next morning to turn the tiny clearing into a good place to work from. They took it in turns to go out with the hand scythe and bring in horse loads of fodder, which they shoved